done. Were you a student here in Valentine Morgenstern's day? Would you have joined the circle? Would you have stood by Valentine's side at the uprising? Raise your hand if you think it's possible. Simon was unsurprised to see not a single hand in the air. He'd played this game back in mundane school, every time his history class covered World War II. Simon knew no one ever thought they would be a Nazi. Simon also knew that, statistically, most of them were wrong. Now I'd like you to raise your hand if you think you're an exemplary shadow hunter, one who would do anything to serve the Clave, Robert said. Unsurprisingly, many more hands shot up this time, John Cartwright's the highest. Robert smiled mirthlessly. It was the most eager and loyal of us who were first to join Valentine's ranks, he told them. It was those of us most dedicated to the Shadowhunter cause who found ourselves the easiest prey. There was a rustling in the crowd. Yes, Robert said. I say us, because I was among Valentine's disciples. I was in the circle. The rustling burst into a storm. Some of the students looked unsurprised, but many of them looked as if a nuclear bomb had just gone off inside their brains. Clary had told Simon that Robert Lightwood used to be a member of the circle, but it was obviously hard for some people to reconcile that with the position of the Inquisitor, which this tall, fearsome man now held. The Inquisitor? Julie breathed, eyes wide. How could they let him? Beatrice looked stunned. My father always said there was something off about him, John murmured. This week, I will teach you about the misuses of power, about great evil, and how it can take many forms. My able daughter, Isabel Lightwood, will be assisting with some of the classwork. Here, he gestured to Isabel, who glanced briefly at the crowd, her impossibly fierce glare somehow growing even fiercer. Most of all, I will teach you about the circle, how it began, and why. If you listen well, some of you might even learn something. Simon wasn't listening at all. Simon was staring at Isabel, willing her to look at him. Isabel studiously stared at her feet. And Robert Lightwood, Inquisitor of the Clave, arbiter of all things lawful, began to tell the story of Valentine Morgenstern and those who had once loved him. 1984. Robert Lightwood stretched out on the quad, trying not to think about how he'd spent this week the year before. The days after exams and before the summer break were, traditionally, a bacchic release of pent-up energy, faculty looking the other way as students pushed the academy rules to their limits. A year ago, he and Michael Wayland had snuck off campus and taken a boldly illicit midnight skinny dip in Lake Lynn. Even with their lips firmly sealed shut, the water had taken its hallucinogenic effect, turning the sky electric. They had lain on their backs, side by side, imagining falling stars carving neon tracks across the clouds, and dreaming themselves into a stranger world. That was a year ago, when Robert had still imagined himself young, free to waste his time with childish delights. Before he had understood that, young or not, he had responsibilities. That was a year ago, before Valentine. The members of the circle had co-opted this quiet, shady corner of the quad, where they would be safe from prying eyes, and where they, in turn, would be spared the sight of their classmates having their pointless, meaningless fun. Robert reminded himself that he was lucky to be huddled here in the shade, listening to Valentine Morgenstern declaim. It was a special privilege, he reminded himself, to be a member of Valentine's coterie, privy to his revolutionary ideas. A year ago, when Valentine had inexplicably befriended him, he felt nothing but intense gratitude and a desire to hang on Valentine's every word. Valentine said the Clave was corrupt and lazy, that these days it cared more about maintaining the status quo and fascistically suppressing dissent than it did carrying out its noble mission. Valentine said the Shadowhunter should stop cowering in the darkness and walk proudly through the mundane world they lived and died to protect. Valentine said the Accords were useless, and the moral cup was built to be used, and the new generation was the hope of the future, and the academy classes were a waste of time. Valentine made Robert's brain buzz and his heart sing. He made Robert feel like a warrior for justice, like he was a part of something, something extraordinary, like he and the others had been chosen, not just by Valentine, but by the hand of destiny, to change the world. And yet, very occasionally, Valentine also made Robert feel uneasy. Valentine wanted the circle's unquestioning loyalty. He wanted their belief in him, their conviction in the cause, to suffuse their souls. And Robert wanted desperately to give that to him. He didn't want to question Valentine's logic or intent. He didn't want to worry that he believed too little in the things that Valentine said, or that he believed too much. Today, showered in sunlight, the infinite possibility of summer opening up before him, he didn't want to worry at all. So, as Valentine's words washed over him, Robert let his focus drift just for a moment. Better to tune out than to doubt. Just for now, his friends could do his listening for him, fill him in later. Wasn't that what friends were for? There were 8 of them today, the circle's innermost circle, all sitting in hushed silence as Valentine ranted about the Clave's kindness to downworlders. Jocelyn Fairchild, Maris Trueblood, Lucian and Amatis Greymark, Hodge Starkweather, and, of course, Michael, Robert, and Stephen. Though Stephen Herondale was the most recent addition to the crowd, and the most recent addition to the Academy, arriving from the London Institute at the beginning of the year, he was also the most devoted to the cause and to Valentine. He'd arrived at the Academy dressed like a mundane. Studded leather jacket, tight, acid-washed jeans, blonde hair gelled into preposterous spikes like the mundane rock stars who postered his dorm room walls. Only a month later, Stephen had adopted not only Valentine's simple, all-black aesthetic, but also his mannerisms, so that the only major difference between them was Valentine's shock of white blonde hair and Stephen's blue eyes. By first frost, he'd sworn off all things mundane and destroyed his beloved Sex Pistols poster in a sacrificial bonfire. "Herondales do nothing halfway," Stephen said whenever Robert teased him about it. But Robert suspected that something lay beneath the light-hearted tone. Something darker. Something hungry. Valentine, he had noticed, had a knack for picking out disciples, honing in on those students with some kind of lack, some inner emptiness that Valentine could fill. Unlike the rest of their gang of misfits, Stephen was ostensibly whole, a handsome, graceful, supremely skilled shadow hunter with a distinguished pedigree and the respect of everyone on campus. It made Robert wonder, what was it that only Valentine could see? His thoughts had wandered so far astray that when Maris gasped and said in a hushed voice, "Won't that be dangerous?" he wasn't sure what she was talking about. Nonetheless, he squeezed her hand reassuringly, as this was what boyfriends were meant to do. Maris was lying with her head in his lap, her silky black hair splayed across his jeans. He smoothed it away from her face, a boyfriend's prerogative. It had been nearly a year, but Robert still found it difficult to believe that this girl, this fierce, graceful, bold girl with a mind like a razor blade, had chosen him as her own. She glided through the academy like a queen, granting favor, indulging her fawning subjects. Maris wasn't the most beautiful girl in their class, and certainly not the sweetest or the most charming. She didn't care for things like sweetness or charm. But when it came to the battlefield, no one was more ready to charge the enemy, and certainly no one was better with a whip. Maris was more than a girl. She was a force. The other girls worshipped her. The guys wanted her. But only Robert had her. It had changed everything. Sometimes Robert felt like his entire life was an act, that it was only a matter of time before his fellow students saw through him and realized what he really was beneath all that brawn and bluster. Cowardly. Weak. Worthless. Having Maris by his side was like wearing a suit of armor. No one like her would choose someone worthless. Everyone knew that. Sometimes Robert even believed it himself. He loved the way she made him feel when they were in public, strong and safe. He loved even more the way she made him feel when they were alone together, when she pressed her lips to the nape of his neck and traced her tongue down the arc of his spine. He loved the curve of her hip and the whisper of her hair. He loved the gleam in her eye when she strode into combat. He loved the taste of her. So why was it that whenever she said, "I love you," he felt like such a liar for saying it back? Why was it that he occasionally, maybe more than occasionally, found his thoughts straying to other girls, to how they might taste? How could he love the way Maris made him feel, and still be so uncertain that what he felt was love? He'd taken to surreptitiously watching the other couples around him, trying to figure out whether they felt the same way, whether their declarations of love masked the same confusion and doubt. But the way Amatis's head nestled comfortably against Stephen's shoulder, the way Jocelyn carelessly threaded her fingers through Valentine's, even the way Maris idly played with his jeans fraying seams as if his clothing, his body, were her property, all of them seemed so certain of themselves. Robert was certain only of how good he'd gotten at faking it. "We should glory in the danger, if it means a chance to take down a filthy rogue downworlder," Valentine said, glowering. "Even if this wolf pack doesn't have a lead on the monster that..." He swallowed hard. And Robert knew what he was thinking, because it seemed like these days it was all Valentine was ever thinking, the fury of it radiating off him as if the thought were written in fire. "The monster that killed my father. Even if it doesn't, we'll be doing the Clave a favor." Ragnar Fell, the green-skinned warlock who taught at the academy for nearly a century, paused halfway across the quad and peered over at them, almost as if he could hear their discussion. Robert assured himself that was impossible. Still, he didn't like the way the warlock's horns angled toward them, as if marking his target. Michael cleared his throat. "Maybe we shouldn't talk like that about downworlders out here." Valentine snorted. "I hope the old goat does hear me. It's a disgrace, them letting him teach here. The only place a downworlder has at the academy is on the dissection table." Michael and Robert exchanged a glance. As always, Robert knew exactly what his parabatai was thinking, and Robert was thinking the same. Valentine, when they first met him, had cut a dashing figure with his blinding white hair and blazing black eyes. His features were smooth and sharp at once, like sculpted ice. But beneath the intimidating veneer was a surprisingly kind boy, roused to anger only by injustice. Valentine had always been intense, yes, but it was an intensity bent toward doing what he believed was right, what was good. When Valentine said he wanted to correct the injustices and inequities imposed on them by the Clave, Robert believed him, and still did. And while Michael may have had a bizarre soft spot for downworlders, Robert didn't like them any more than Valentine did. He couldn't imagine why, in this day and age, the Clave was still allowing warlocks to meddle in Shadowhunter affairs. But there was a difference between clear-eyed intensity and irrational anger. Robert had been waiting a long time now for Valentine's grief-fueled rage to simmer down. Instead, it had sparked an inferno. "So you won't tell us where you got your intel from," Lucien said, the only one other than Jocelyn who could question Valentine with impunity. "But you want us to sneak off campus and hunt down these werewolves ourselves? If you're so sure the Clave would want them taken care of, why not leave it to them?" "The Clave's useless," Valentine hissed. "You know that better than anyone, Lucien. But if none of you are willing to risk yourselves for this, if you'd rather stay here and go to a party..." His mouth curled as if even speaking the word repelled him. "I'll go myself." Hodge pushed his glasses up on his nose and leaped to his feet. "I'll go with you, Valentine," he said, too loud. It was Hodge's way, always a little too loud or too quiet, always misreading the room. There was a reason he preferred books to people. "I'm always at your side." "Sit down," Valentine snapped. "I don't need you getting in the way. But what good does your loyalty do me when it comes with a big mouth and two left feet?" Hodge paled and dropped back to the ground, eyes blinking furiously behind thick lenses. Jocelyn pressed a hand to Valentine's shoulder, ever so gently. And only for a moment, but it was enough. I only mean, Hodge, that your particular skills are wasted on the battlefield, Valentine said, more kindly. The shift in tone was abrupt, but sincere. When Valentine favored you with his warmest smile, he was impossible to resist. And I couldn't forgive myself if you were injured. I can't lose anyone else. They were all silent then, for a moment, thinking of how quickly it had happened, the dean pulling Valentine off the training field to deliver the news, the way he'd taken it, silent and steady, like a shadow hunter should. The way he'd looked when he returned to campus after the funeral. His hollow eyes, his sallow skin, his face aging years in a week. Their parents were all warriors, and they knew. What Valentine had lost, any of them could lose. To be a shadow hunter was to live in the shadow of death. They couldn't bring his father back, but if they could help him avenge the loss, surely they owed him that much. Robert, at least, owed him everything. Of course we'll come with you, Robert said firmly. Whatever you need. Agreed, Michael said. Where Robert went, he would always follow. Valentine nodded. Stephen? Lucian? Robert caught Amatis rolling her eyes. Valentine never treated the women with anything less than respect, but when it came to battle, he preferred to fight with men by his side. Stephen nodded. Lucian, who was Valentine's parapetai and the one he relied on most, shifted uncomfortably. I promised Celine I would tutor her tonight, he admitted. I could cancel it, of course, but... Valentine waved him off, laughing, and the others followed suit.
Tutoring? Is that what they're calling it these days? Stephen teased. Seems like she's already aced her O-levels and wrapping you around her little finger.
Lucian blushed. Nothing's happening there, trust me, he said, and it was presumably the truth. Celine, 3 years younger, with the fragile, delicately pretty features of a porcelain doll, had been trailing their group like a lost puppy. It was obvious to anyone with eyes that she'd fallen hard for Stephen, but he was a lost cause, pledged to Amatis for life. She'd picked Lucian as her consolation prize. But it was just as obvious that Lucian had no romantic interest in anyone but Jocelyn Fairchild. Obvious, that is, to everyone except Jocelyn. We don't need you for this one, Valentine told Lucian. Stay and enjoy yourself. I should be with you, Lucian said. The merriment faded from his voice. He sounded pained at the thought of Valentine venturing into dangerous territory without him. And Robert understood. Parabatai didn't always fight side by side, but knowing your Parabatai was in danger without you there to support and protect him, it caused an almost physical pain. And Lucian and Valentine's Parabatai bond was even more intense than most. Robert could almost feel the current of power flowing between them, the strength and love they passed back and forth with every glance. Where you go, I go. It's already decided, my friend, Valentine said, and that simply it was. Lucian would stay on campus with the others. Valentine, Stephen, Michael, and Robert would slip away from campus after dark and venture into Brosselind Forest in pursuit of a werewolf encampment that, supposedly, could lead them to Valentine's father's killer. They'd make up the rest as they went along. As the others hurried off to the dining hall for lunch, Maris grabbed Robert's hand and pulled him close. You'll be careful out there, yes? She said sternly. Maris said everything sternly. It was one of the things he liked best about her. She pressed her lithe body against his, kissed his neck, and he felt in that moment a passing sense of supreme confidence that this was where he belonged. At least until she whispered, Come home to me in one piece. Come home to me, as if he belonged to her, as if, in her mind, they were already married with a house and children and a lifetime of togetherness, as if the future was already decided. It was the appeal of Maris, as it was the appeal of Valentine, the ease with which they could be so sure of what should be and what was to come. Robert continued hoping that one day it would rub off on him. In the meantime, the less certain he was, the more certain he acted. There was no need for anyone to know the truth. Robert Lightwood wasn't much of a teacher. He gave them a neatly sanitized account of the early days of the Circle, laying out Valentine's revolutionary principles as if they were a list of ingredients for baking a particularly bland cake. Simon, fruitlessly devoting most of his energy to telepathic communication with Isabel, was barely listening. He found himself cursing the fact that Shadowhunters were so haughty about the whole we-don't-do-magic thing. If he were a warlock, he'd probably be able to command Isabel's attention with the flick of a finger. Or if he were still a vampire, he could have used his vampy powers to enthrall her. But that was something Simon preferred not to think about, because it raised some unsettling questions about how he'd managed to enthrall her in the first place. What he did hear of Robert's tale didn't much interest him. Simon had never liked history much, at least as it was relayed to him in school. It sounded too much like a brochure, everything neatly laid out and painfully obvious in retrospect. Every war had its bullet-pointed causes. Every megalomaniac dictator was so cartoonishly evil, you wondered how stupid the people of the past had to be not to notice. Simon didn't remember much of his own history-making experiences, but he remembered enough to know it wasn't so clear when it was happening. History, the way teachers liked it, was a racetrack, a straight shot from start to finish line. Life itself was more of a maze. Maybe the telepathy worked after all. Because when the speech ended and the students were given permission to disperse, Isabel hopped off the stage and strolled right up to Simon. She gave him a sharp nod, hello. "Isabel, maybe we could..." She flashed him a brilliant smile that, for just a moment, made him think all his worrying had been for nothing. Then she said, "Aren't you going to introduce me to your friends? Especially the handsome ones?" Simon turned to see half the class crowding in behind him, eager for a brush with the famous Isabel Lightwood. At the front of the pack were George and John, the latter practically drooling. John elbowed past Simon and thrust out a hand. "John Cartwright, at your service," he said in a voice that oozed charm like a blister-oozed pus. Isabel took his hand, and instead of jujitsuing him to the ground with a humiliating thump, or slicing his hand off at the wrist with her electrum whip, she let him turn her hand over and bring it to his lips. Then she curtsied. She winked. Worst of all, she giggled. Simon thought he might puke. Unendurable minutes of torment passed, George blushing and making goofy attempts at jokes, Julie struck speechless, Marsol pretending to be above it all, Beatrice engaging in wan but polite small talk about mutual acquaintances, Sunil bouncing in the back of the crowd trying to make himself seen, and through it all, John smirking and Isabel beaming and batting her eyes in a display that could only be meant to make Simon's stomach churn. At least he desperately hoped it was meant for that. Because the other option, the possibility that Isabel was smiling at John simply because she wanted to, and that she accepted his invitation to squeeze his rock-hard biceps because she wanted to feel his muscles contract beneath her delicate grip, was unthinkable. "So what do you people do around here for fun?" she asked finally, then narrowed her eyes flirtatiously at John. "And don't say me." "Am I already dead?" Simon thought, hopelessly. "Is this hell?" "Neither the circumstances nor the population here have proven themselves conducive to fun," John said pompously, as if the bluster in his voice could disguise the fire in his cheeks. "That all changes tonight," Isabel said, then turned on her spiky heel and strode away. George shook his head, letting out an appreciative whistle. "Simon, your girlfriend." "Ex-girlfriend," John put in.
"She's magnificent," Julie breathed,
and from the looks on the others' faces, she was speaking for the group. Simon rolled his eyes and hurried after Isabel, reaching out to grab her shoulder, then thinking better of it at the last moment. Grabbing Isabel Lightwood from behind was probably an invitation to amputation.
"Isabel," he said sharply.
She sped up, So did he, wondering where she was headed. Isabel, he said again. They burrowed deeper into the school, the air thick with damp and mold, the stone floor increasingly slick beneath their feet. They hit a fork, corridors branching off to the left and right, and she paused before choosing the one on the left.
We don't go down this one, generally, Simon said.
Nothing.
Mostly because of the elephant-sized slug that lives at the end of it.
This was not an exaggeration. Rumor had it that some disgruntled faculty member, a warlock who'd been fired when the tide turned against Downworlders, had left it behind as a parting gift. Isabel kept walking, slower now, picking her way carefully over seeping puddles of slime. Something skittered loudly overhead. She didn't flinch, but she did look up, and Simon caught her fingers playing across the coiled whip. Also because of the rats, he added. He and George had gone on an expedition down this corridor in search of the supposed slug. They gave up after the third rat dropped from the ceiling and somehow found its way down George's pants. Isabel breathed a heavy sigh.
Come on, Izzy, hold up.
Somehow he'd stumbled on the magic words. She spun around to face him.
Don't call me that,
she hissed.
What? My friends call me Izzy,
she said.
You lost that right. Izzy, Isabel, I mean, if you'd read my letter. No, you don't call me Izzy. You don't send me letters. You don't follow me into dark corridors and try to save me from rats.
Trust me, we see a rat, it's every man for himself. Isabel looked like she wanted to feed him to the giant slug.
My point, Simon Lewis, is that you and I are strangers now, just like you wanted it.
If that's true, then what are you doing here?
Isabel looked incredulous.
It's one thing for Jace to believe the world revolves around him, but come on. I know you love fantasy, Simon, but the suspension of disbelief can only go so far.
This is my school, Isabel, Simon said.
And you're my...
She just stared at him, as if defying him to come up with a noun that would justify the possessive.
This wasn't going the way he'd planned. Okay, then, why are you here? And why are you being so nice to all my... friends? Because my father's forcing me to be here, she said. Because I guess he thinks some delightful father-daughter bonding time in a slime-covered pit will make me forget that he's a deadbeat adulterer who ditched his family. And I'm being nice to your friends because I'm a nice person.
Now it was Simon who looked incredulous.
Okay, I'm not, she admitted. But I've never actually been to school, you know. I figured if I have to be here, I might as well make the best of it. See what I'm missing. Is that enough information for you?
I get that you're mad at me, but... She shook her head.
You don't get it. I'm not mad at you. I'm not anything at you, Simon. You asked me to accept that you were a different person now, someone who I don't know. So I've accepted that. I loved someone. He's gone now. You're nobody I know, and as far as I can tell, nobody I need to know. I'll only be here for a few days, and then we never need to see each other again. How about we don't make it harder than it has to be?
He couldn't quite catch his breath.
I loved someone, she'd said. And it was the closest she or any girl had ever come to saying, I love you, to Simon. Except that it wasn't close at all, was it?
It was a world away.
Okay.
It was the only word he could force out, but she was already walking on down the corridor. She didn't need his permission to be a stranger. She didn't need anything from him.
You're going the wrong way, he called after her.
He didn't know where she wanted to go, but there seemed little chance she wanted to go slugward.
They're all wrong, she called back without turning around.
He tried to sense some subtext in her words, a glimmer of pain. Something that would give the lie to her claim, betray the feeling she still harbored for him, prove this was as hard and confusing for her as it was for him. But the suspension of disbelief could only go so far.
Isabel had said she wanted to make the best of her time at the academy, and she'd proposed they not make it any harder than it needed to be. Unfortunately, Simon soon discovered, these two things were mutually exclusive. Because Isabel's version of making the best of things involved Isabel stretched out like a cat on one of the student lounge's musty leather couches, surrounded by sycophants,
Isabel partaking in George's illicit supply of scotch, and inviting the others to do so as well, so that soon all of Simon's friends and enemies were drunk and giddy, and in much too good a mood for his liking. Making the best of things apparently meant encouraging Julie to flirt with George, and teaching Marisol how to smash statuary with a whip, and, worst of all, agreeing to maybe be John Cartwright's date for the end-of-year party later in the week. Simon wasn't sure whether any of this was harder than it needed to be. Who knew what qualified as needed to be? But it was excruciating. "So when does the real fun start?" Isabel finally said. John waggled his eyebrows. "Just say the word." Isabel laughed and touched his shoulder. Simon wondered whether the Academy would expel him for murdering John Cartwright in his sleep.
"Not that kind of fun. I mean, when do we sneak off campus? Go party in Alicante, go swimming in Lake Lynn, go..."
She trailed off, finally noticing that the others were gaping at her like she was speaking in tongues.
"Are you telling me you don't do any of that?"
"We're not here to have fun," Beatrice said, somewhat stiffly. "We're here to learn to be shadow hunters. There are rules for a reason." Isabel rolled her eyes.
"Haven't you ever heard that rules are meant to be broken? Students are supposed to get into a little trouble at the Academy. At least the best students are. Why do you think the rules are so strict? So that only the best can get around them. Think of it like extra credit."
"How would you know?" Beatrice asked. Simon was surprised by her tone. Usually she was the quietest among them, always willing to go with the flow. But there was an edge in her voice now, something that reminded him that, gentle as she seemed, she was a born warrior. "It's not like you went here."
"I come from a long line of Academy graduates," Isabel said. "I know what I need to know." "We're not all interested in following in your father's footsteps," Beatrice said, then stood up and walked out of the room.
There was silence in her wake, everyone tensely waiting for Isabel to react. Her smile didn't waver, but Simon could feel the heat radiating from her and understood it was taking a great deal of energy for her not to explode or collapse. He didn't know which it would be. He didn't know how she felt about her father once being one of Valentine's men. He didn't know anything about her, not really. He admitted that. But he still wanted to scoop her into his arms and hold her until the storm passed.
"No one has ever accused my father of being fun," Isabel said flatly. "But I assume my reputation precedes me. If you meet me here at midnight tomorrow, I'll show you what you've been missing."
She took John's hand in her own and allowed him to pull her off the couch.
"Now, will you show me to my room? This place is simply impossible to navigate."
"My pleasure," John said, winking at Simon. Then they were gone, together. The next morning, the hall echoed with yawning and the groan of hangovers and fruitless search of grease and coffee. As Robert Lightwood launched into his second lecture, some tedious disquisition on the nature of evil and a point-by-point analysis of Valentine's critique of the Accords, Simon had to keep pinching himself awake. Robert Lightwood was possibly the only person on the planet who could make the story of the Circle drop-dead boring. It didn't help that Simon had stayed up till dawn, tossing and turning on the lumpy mattress, trying to drive nightmare images of Isabel and John out of his head. There's something going on with her. Simon was sure of it. Maybe it wasn't about him. Maybe it was about her father, or some residual homeschooling issues, or just some girl thing he couldn't fathom. But she wasn't acting like herself. "She's not your girlfriend," he kept reminding himself. Even if something was wrong, it was no longer his job to fix it. She can do what she wants. And if what she wanted was John Cartwright, then obviously she wasn't worth losing a night of sleep over in the first place. By sunrise, he'd almost managed to convince himself of this. But there she was again, up on stage beside her father, her fierce and fiercely intelligent gaze evoking all those annoying feelings again. They weren't memories, exactly. Simon couldn't have named a single movie they watched together. He didn't know any of Isabel's favorite foods or inside jokes. He didn't know what it felt like to kiss her,
or twine his fingers with hers. What he felt whenever he looked at her was deeper than that, dwelling in some nether region of his mind. He felt like he knew her, inside and out. He felt like he had Superman vision and could X-ray her soul. He felt sorrow and loss, and joy and confusion. He felt a caveman-like urge to slaughter a wild boar and lay it at her feet. He felt the need to do something extraordinary, and the belief that, in her presence, he could. He felt something he'd never felt before, but he had a sinking sensation that he recognized it anyway. He was pretty sure he felt like he was in love.
1984. Valentine made it easy for them. He'd induced permission from the dean for an educational camping trip in Brosalind Forest. 2 days and nights, free to do as they pleased, as long as it resulted in a few scribbled pages on the curative powers of wild herbs. By all rights, with his uncomfortable questions and rebellious theories, Valentine should have been the black sheep of Shadowhunter Academy. Ragnar Fell certainly treated him like a slimy creature who'd crawled out from under a rock and should be hastily returned there. But the rest of the faculty seemed blinded by Valentine's personal magnetism, unable or unwilling to see through to the disrespect that lay beneath. He was endlessly dodging deadlines and ducking out of classes, excusing himself with nothing more than the flash of a smile. Another student might have been grateful for the latitude, but it only made Valentine loathe his teachers more. Every loophole the faculty opened for him was only more evidence of weakness. He had no qualms about enjoying its consequences. The werewolf pack, according to Valentine's intel, was holed up in the old Silverhood Manor, a decrepit ruin at the heart of the forest. The last Silverhood had died in battle 2 generations before, and was used as a name to spook young Shadowhunter children. The death of a soldier was one thing, regrettable, but the natural order of things. The death of a line was unimaginable. Maybe they were all secretly apprehensive about it, this illicit mission that seemed to cross an invisible line. Never before had they struck against downworlders without the express permission and oversight of their elders. They had broken rules, but never before had they strayed so close to breaking the law. Maybe they just wanted to spend a few more hours like normal teenagers before they went so far they couldn't turn back. For whatever reason, the four of them made their way through the woods with a deliberate lack of speed, setting up camp for the night a half mile from the Silverhood estate. They would, Valentine decided, spend the day staking out the werewolf encampment, gauging its strengths and weaknesses, charting the rhythms of the pack, and attack at nightfall, once the pack had dispersed to hunt. But that was tomorrow's problem. That night they sat around a campfire, roasted sausages over leaping flames, reminisced about their pasts, and rhapsodized about their futures, which still seemed impossibly far away.
"I'll marry Jocelyn, of course," Valentine said, "and we'll raise our children in the new era. They'll never be warped by the corrupt laws of a weak, sniveling clave."
"Sure, because by that time, we'll run the world," Stephen said lightly. Valentine's grim smile made it seem less like a joke than a promise. "Can't you just see it?" Michael said. Daddy Valentine, knee-deep in diapers, a busload of the kids.
"However many Jocelyn wants."
Valentine's expression softened, as it always did when he said her name. They'd only been together a couple of months, since his father died. But no one questioned that they were together for good. The way he looked at her, like she was a different species than the rest of them, a higher species.
"Can't you see it?"
Valentine had confided once, early on, when Robert asked him how he could be so sure of love so soon. "There's more of the angel in her than in the rest of us. There's greatness in her. She shines like Raziel himself." "You just want to flood the gene pool," Michael said. "I imagine you think the world would be better off if every shadow hunter had a little Morgenstern in them." Valentine grinned. "I'm told false modesty doesn't suit me, so no comment." "While we're on the subject," Stephen said, a blush rising in his cheeks, "I've asked Amadis, and she said yes."
"Asked what?" Robert said.
Michael and Valentine only laughed as Stephen's cheeks took fire.
To marry me, he admitted.
What do you think? The question was ostensibly directed to all of them, but his gaze was fixed on Valentine, who hesitated an impossibly long time before answering.
Amatis, he said finally, furrowing his brow as if he'd have to give the matter some serious thought.
Stephen caught his breath, and in that moment, Robert almost thought it was possible that he needed Valentine's approval, that despite proposing to Amatis, despite loving her so deeply and desperately that he nearly vibrated with emotion whenever she came near, despite writing her that abominable love song Robert had once found crumpled under his bed, Stephen would cast her aside if Valentine commanded it. In that moment, Robert almost thought it was possible that Valentine would command it, just to see what happened. Then Valentine's face relaxed into a wide smile, and he threw an arm around Stephen, saying,
"It's about time. I don't know what you were waiting for, you idiot. When you're lucky enough to have a Greymark by your side, you do whatever you can to make sure it's forever. I should know."
Then everyone was laughing and toasting and plotting bachelor party schemes and teasing Stephen about his short-lived attempts at songwriting. And it was Robert who felt like the idiot, imagining even for a second that Stephen's love for Amatis could waver, or that Valentine had anything but their best interests at heart. These were his friends, the best he would ever have, or anyone could ever have. These were his comrades in arms. In nights like these, bursts of joy beneath starry skies were their reward for the special obligation they'd taken upon themselves. To imagine otherwise was only a symptom of Robert's secret weakness, his inveterate lack of conviction, and he resolved not to let himself do so again.
"And you, old man?" Valentine asked Robert. "As if I even have to ask. We all know Maris does what she wants."
"And inexplicably, she seems to want you," Stephen added.
Michael, who had fallen unusually silent, caught Robert's eye. Only Michael knew how little Robert liked to think about the future, especially this part of it. How much he dreaded being forced into marriage, parenting, responsibility. If it were up to Robert, he would stay at the academy forever. It made little sense. Because of what had happened when he was a kid, he was a couple of years older than his friends. He should have been chafing at the restrictions of youth. But maybe, because of what had happened, part of him would always feel cheated and want that time back. He'd spent so long wanting the life he had now. He wasn't ready to let go of it quite yet.
"Well, this old man is exhausted," Robert said, dodging the question. "I think my tent is calling."
As they extinguished the fire and tidied up the site, Michael shot him a grateful smile, having been spared his own interrogation. The only one of them still single, Michael disliked this line of conversation even more than Robert did. It was one of the many things they had in common. They both enjoyed each other's company more than that of any girl. Marriage seemed like such a misguided concept, Robert sometimes thought. How could he care for any wife more than he did for his parabatai, the other half of his soul? Why should he possibly be expected to? He couldn't sleep. When he emerged from the tent into the silent pre-dawn, Michael was sitting by the ashes of the campfire. He turned toward Robert without surprise, almost as if he'd been waiting for his parabatai to join him. Maybe he had. Robert didn't know whether it was an effect of the bonding ritual or simply the definition of a best friend, but he and Michael lived and breathed in similar rhythms. Before they were roommates, they'd often run into each other in the academy corridors, sleeplessly roaming the night. "Walk?" Michael suggested. Robert nodded. They traipsed wordlessly through the woods, letting the sounds of the sleeping forest wash over them. Screeches of night birds, skitters of insects, the hush of wind through fluttering leaves, the soft crunch of grass and twigs beneath their feet. There were dangers lurking here. They both knew that well enough. Many of the Academy's training missions took place in Brosselind Forest, its dense trees a useful refuge for werewolves, vampires, and even the occasional demons. Though most of those were unleashed by the Academy itself, an ultimate test for particularly promising students.
This night, the forest felt safe. Or maybe it was simply that Robert felt invincible. As they walked, he thought not of the mission to come, but of Michael, who had been his first true friend. He'd had friends when he was young, he supposed. The kids growing up in Alicante all knew each other, and he had vague memories of exploring the glass city with small bands of children, their faces interchangeable, their loyalties non-existent. As he discovered for himself the year he turned 12 and got his first mark. This was, for most Shadowhunter children, a proud day. One they looked forward to and fantasized about the way mundane children inexplicably fixated on birthdays. In some families, the first rune was applied in a quick, business-like fashion, the child marked and sent on his way. In others there was great festivity, presents, balloons, a celebratory feast. And of course, in a very small number of families, the first rune was the last rune, the touch of the steely burning the child's skin, sending him into shock or madness, a fever so intense that only cutting through the mark would save the life. Those children would never be shadow hunters. Those families would never be the same. No one ever thought it would happen to them. At 12, Robert had been scrawny but sure-footed, quick for his age, strong for his size, sure of the shadow hunting glory that awaited him. As his extended family looked on, his father carefully traced the Voyant's rune across Robert's hand. The steely's tip carved its graceful lines across his pale skin. The completed mark blazed bright. So bright Robert shut his eyes from the glare of it. That was the last thing he remembered. The last he remembered clearly, at least. After that there was everything he tried so hard to forget. There was pain. There was the pain that seared through him like a lightning strike, and the pain that ebbed and flowed like a tide. There was the pain in his body, lines of agony radiating from the mark, burrowing from his flesh to his organs, to his bones. And then, so much worse, there was the pain in his mind, or maybe it was his soul, an ineffable sensation of hurt, as if some creature had burrowed into the depths of his brain and gotten hungrier with the firing of every neuron and synapse. It hurt to think, it hurt to feel, it hurt to remember. But it felt necessary to do these things, because even in the heart of this agony, some dim part of Robert stayed alert enough to know that if he didn't hang on, didn't feel the hurt, he would slip away forever. Later, he would use all these words and more to try to describe the pain, but none of them captured the experience. What had happened, what he had felt, that was beyond words. There were other torments to endure. Through that eternity he lay in bed, insensible to all around him, imprisoned by his mark. There were visions. He saw demons taunting and torturing him, and worse. He saw the faces of those he loved, telling him he was unworthy, telling him he was better off dead. He saw charred, barren plains and a wall of fire, the hell dimension awaiting him if he let his mind slip away. And so, through it all, somehow, he held on. He lost all sense of himself and the world around him, lost his words and his name. But he held on. Until finally, 1 month later, the pain abated. The visions faded. Robert awoke. He learned, once he'd recovered himself enough to understand and care, that he'd been semi-conscious for several weeks, while a battle had been raging around him, members of the clave warring with his parents over his treatment, as two silent brothers did their best to keep him alive. They had all wanted to strip him of the mark, his parents told him, his silent brothers warning daily that this was the only way to ensure his survival and spare him further pain. Let him live out his life as a mundane. This was the conventional treatment for shadow hunters who couldn't bear marks. "We couldn't let them do that to you," his mother told him. "You're a Lightwood. You were born to this life," his father told him. "This life and no other." What they didn't say, and didn't need to: "We would rather see you dead than mundane." Things were different between them after that. Robert was grateful to his parents for believing in him. He too would rather be dead. that it changed something. Knowing his parents' love for him had a limit. Something must have changed for them, too. Discovering that a part of their son couldn't handle the Shadow Hunter life. Being forced to bear that shame. Now Robert could no longer remember what his family had been like before the Mark. He remembered only the years since. The coldness that lived between them. They acted their parts. Loving father, doting mother, dutiful son. But it was in their presence that Robert felt most alone. He was, in those months, spent recovering, frequently alone. The kids he'd thought of as his friends wanted nothing to do with him. When forced into his presence, they shied away as if he were contagious. There was nothing wrong with him, the Silent Brothers said. Having survived the ordeal with the Mark intact, there was no risk of future danger. His body had teetered on the edge of rejection, but his will had turned the tide. When the Silent Brothers examined him for the last time, one of them spoke somberly inside his head, with a message for Robert alone.
You will be tempted to think this ordeal marks you as weak. Instead, remember it as proof of your strength.
But Robert was 12 years old. His former friends were tracing themselves with runes, shipping off to the academy, doing everything normal shadow hunters were supposed to do. While Robert hid away in his bedroom, abandoned by his friends, cold-shouldered by his family, and afraid of his own Steely. In the face of so much evidence for weakness, even a Silent Brother couldn't make him feel strong. In this way, nearly a year passed, and Robert began to imagine this would be the shape of the rest of his life. He would be a shadow hunter in name only, a shadow hunter afraid of the Marks. Sometimes, in the dark of night, he wished his will hadn't been so strong, that he'd let himself be lost. It would have to be better than the life he'd returned to. Then he met Michael Wayland, and everything changed. They hadn't known each other very well before. Michael was a strange kid, allowed to tag along with the others, but never quite accepted. He was prone to distraction and strange flights of fancy, pausing in the middle of a sparring session to consider where the sensors had come from and who had thought to invent them. Michael had shown up at the Lightwoods Manor one day, asking if Robert might like to go for a horseback ride. They spent several hours galloping through the countryside, and once it was over, Michael said, "See you tomorrow," as if it were a foregone conclusion. He kept coming back. "Because you're interesting," Michael said, when Robert finally asked him why. That was another thing about Michael. He always said exactly what was in his head, no matter how tactless or peculiar. "My mother made me promise not to ask about what happened to you," he added.
"Why?"
"Because it would be rude. What do you think? Would it be rude?" Robert shrugged. No one ever asked him about it or referred to it, not even his parents. It had never occurred to him to wonder why, or whether this was preferable. It was simply the way things were. "I don't mind being rude," Michael said. "Will you tell me what it was like?" Strange that it could be that simple. Strange that Robert could be burning to tell someone without even realizing it. That all he needed was someone to ask. The floodgates opened. Robert talked and talked, and when he trailed off afraid he was going too far, Michael would jump in with another question. "Why do you think it happened to you?" Michael asked. "Do you think it was genetic, or like some part of you just isn't meant to be a shadow hunter?" It was, of course, Robert's greatest, most secret fear. But to hear it tossed off so casually like this diffused it of all its power. "Maybe," Robert said, and instead of shunning him, Michael's eyes lit up with a scientist's curiosity. He grinned. "We should find out." They made it their mission. They probed libraries, pored over ancient texts, asked questions that no adult wanted to hear. There was very little written record of shadow hunters who'd experienced what Robert had. This kind of thing was meant to be a shameful family secret, never spoken of again. Not that Michael cared how many feathers you ruffled or which traditions he overturned. He wasn't particularly brave, but he seemed to have no fear. Their mission failed. There was no rational explanation for why Robert had reacted so strongly to the Mark. But by the end of that year, it didn't matter. Michael had turned a nightmare into a puzzle, and had turned himself into Robert's best friend.
They performed the Parabatai ritual before leaving for the academy, swearing the oath without hesitation. By then they were 15 years old, a physically unlikely pairing. Robert had finally hit his growth spurt and loomed over his peers, his muscles thick, his shadow of a beard growing in thicker every day. Michael was slim and wiry, his unruly curls and dreamy expression making him look younger than his age. "Entreat me not to leave thee, or return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The angel do so to me, and more also. If aught but death, part thee and me." Robert recited the words, but they were unnecessary. Their bond had been cemented the day he turned 14, when he finally got up the nerve to mark himself again. Michael was the only one he told, and as he held the steely over his skin, it was Michael's steady gaze that gave him the courage to bear down. Unthinkable that they had only one last year together before they'd be expected to part. Their Parabatai bond would remain after the academy, of course. They'd always be best friends. They'd always charge into battle side by side. But it wouldn't be the same. They'd each marry, move into houses of their own, refocus their attention and their love. They would always have a claim on each other's souls. But after next year, they would no longer be the most important person in each other's lives. This, Robert knew, was simply how life worked. This was growing up. He just couldn't imagine it, and he didn't want to. As if listening in on Robert's thoughts, Michael echoed the question he dodged earlier. "What really is going on with you and Maris?" he asked. "Do you think it's for real? Like, for good?" There was no need to put on a show for Michael. "I don't know," he said honestly. "I don't even know what that would feel like. She's perfect for me. I love spending time with her. I love, you know, with her. But does that mean I love her? It should, but something's missing." "Not between us, though," Robert said. "It's like there's something missing in me. I see how Stephen looks at Amatis, how Valentine looks at Jocelyn." "How Lucian looks at Jocelyn," Michael added with a wry grin. They both liked Lucian, despite his irritating tendency to act like Valentine's favorite had given him insight beyond his years. But after all these years of watching him pine away for Jocelyn, it was hard to take him entirely seriously. The same went for Jocelyn, who somehow managed to remain oblivious. Robert didn't understand how you could be the center of someone's world without even realizing it. "I don't know," he admitted, wondering if any girl would ever be the center of his world. "Sometimes I worry there's something wrong with me." Michael clapped a hand to his shoulder and fixed him with an intense gaze. "There's nothing wrong with you, Robert. I wish you could finally see that." Robert shook off the hand, along with the weight of the moment. "How about you?" he said with forced gaiety. "It's been, what, 3 dates with Eliza Rosewayne?" 4, Michael admitted. He'd sworn Robert to secrecy about her, saying he didn't want the other guys to know until he was sure it was real. Robert suspected he didn't want Valentine to know, as Eliza was a particular thorn in Valentine's side. She asked nearly as many disrespectful questions as he did, and harbored a similar disdain for the current policies of the Clave. But she wanted nothing to do with the Circle or its goals. Eliza thought that a new, united front with mundanes and downworlders was the key to the future. She argued, loudly, and to the disgust of most of the faculty and students, that the Shadowhunters should be addressing the problems of the mundane world. She could often be found in the quad, shoving unwanted leaflets in students' faces, ranting about nuclear testing, Middle East oil tyrants, some trouble no one understood in South Africa, some disease no one wanted to acknowledge in America. Robert had heard every lecture in full, because Michael always insisted on staying to listen. "It's very odd," Michael said. "I like it." "Oh,
It was a surprise, a not entirely pleasant one. Michael never liked anyone. Until this moment, Robert hadn't realized how much he had counted on that.